Good morning. A bit of a rainy morning, but we're at our usual lockdown destination of St. James the Great Church in East Malling. Stuart's with me and we've braved the flood, so we've got all sorts of things that we've had to deal with this morning to bring you podcast number 5. Now, we stood here on the last podcast and we really enjoyed going to Cornwall in our minds and in the music. Today, we're taking you to Scotland.
Well, you mentioned the floods just now at the end of Church Walk. We're actually going to the land of the mountain and the flood with the Scottish composer Hamish McCun. We thought we'd go north of the border because there is a great deal of musical heritage there. In the 19th century, there was in Scotland a mirror of what we experienced here with the English musical renaissance. We had composers in Scotland such as Hamish McCun, Sir John Blackwood McEwan. McEwan was born in 1868. The same year as McCun. These people, McEwan, McCun, and also Sir Alexander Mackenzie, who famously wrote an overture called Britannia. The composers, although they were Scottish and they had a great reverence for the landscape and the culture of Scotland, the composers were actually very much part of a British musical renaissance. For Hamish McCun, the inspiration was very much in the realm of Sir Walter Scott, the idea of the swashbuckling legends of the landscape and the great rivers of Scotland. And all of this comes together in McCun overture, The Land of the Mountain and the Flood, which he wrote just at the age of 19, which was an extraordinary achievement. Whenever you hear programmes about Scotland, oh, there's some Scottish wolves there in the background. Whenever you hear about Scotland in television programmes, radio programmes, they always start off with Mendelssohn's The Hebrides overture, which is a lovely, beautiful piece. But for me, the true essence of Scotland is McCun's music, The Land of the Mountain and the Flood.
Let's start with
the very famous recording that was made in 1968 by Sir Alexander Gibson, great Scottish conductor, and the Scottish National Orchestra. I think when we listen to this, you can almost see Richard Hannay or Robert Powell running through the heather, the sense of the border raiders, the sea reavers, all that goes into Walter Scott and the legends of Rob Roy and so on. This is geography poured into music and legend and landscape.
Thank you.
Scott was very much the inspiration for McCann. It's quite amusing, actually. I think you may need to take this to the BBC fact checker. Pol Pot was a fan of Walter Scott. I seem to have read that somewhere. Ivanhoe was his favourite novel. You'll have to check that.
I will, because I've been and filmed. I went to Cambodia with the BBC to film, and I walked into the horrific area that is the killing fields. Yes. And to imagine that monster sitting down with Sir Walter Scott, it's just a bit too much of a stretch.
It's interesting you should say that, because Stalin kept a very methodical record collection, and apparently he used to write his views of the recorder on the record sleeves. Could have taken the second movement a bit quicker. Perhaps this is the one saving grace that the dictators had, that they had some contact with classical music.
We imagine, didn't we, on Radio 3, Stalin's Top 20.
Private Passion.
Marshall Stalin.
With Michael Barclay and Joseph Stalin.
We're going on to Malcolm Arnold. He was an English composer and wrote 9 symphonies, an incredible amount of film music. In his output, he went back to the folk roots of Britain. He wrote a set of English dances, Cornish dances, and Scottish dances. Now, there's a bit of a devolution imbalance here, because Arnold's English dances consisted of a set of 8. The Scottish dances are just 4. That shows you that devolution doesn't always work. The Scottish dances were written in 1957. I mentioned that Arnold went back to folk roots and folk ideas, but none of the actual tunes that he uses were real folk tunes. They were all his own inventions. The 4 Scottish dances are a very faithful impression of the Scottish cadence, the Scottish snap. One of the movements that we will play is this magnificent slow movement in the Scottish dances, which, if you can imagine Loch Lomond or Loch Ness, or a great expanse of the landscape and some sort of romantic tune of the heart coming across the air. And this is what we find in the 3rd movement of Malcolm Arnold's Scottish dances.
Well, we move now from Sir Malcolm Arnold to
Sir Peter Maxwell Davis.
Well known for his joy in Scottish living, wasn't he?
He was. He was born in Salford. Interesting, actually, because the year in which Maxwell Davis and Bert Whistle were born was the year in which Elgar, Delius and Holst all died. A remarkable, strange thing. Maxwell Davis and Bert Whistle, they were all friends in the early days of British modernism. And Maxwell Davis pursued a very diligent career. First, he was a teacher of music at Cirencester Grammar School, where he lived a very monastic existence. His first orchestral work was a very atonal impression of northern landscape. It was written in 1955.
Atonal, so there was a sort of link between what he was doing at that time and what Harrison Birtwistle's doing.
Yes, so they were part of the new wave of British music. Maxwell Davis sort of gravitated back to tonality, or at least a tunefulness. Many of the great modernist scores are quite hard for ordinary people to deal with and to fathom. So when Maxwell Davis eventually packed up and went to the Orkney Islands and founded his Magnus Festival there, he wanted music to be played by ordinary people to the average man in the street. Maxwell Davis sort of went full circle, and he also went from being the enfant terrible of music to being master of the Queen's music, and Sir Peter Maxwell Davis. It's quite a career progression. There was a very interesting programme a few years ago on Radio 3 in which their presenter Tom Service actually visited Maxwell Davis at his home. Tom Service was intrigued by various charms and magic symbols over doorways in Maxwell Davis's house. Tom Service sort of said, "Oh, look at these magic symbols here." And Maxwell Davis said, "Well, how do you know that they don't work?" So Maxwell Davis sort of believed in the mysteries of the landscape.
Yes.
And this comes over very much in his music. In the 1930s, the Kent-born film director, Michael Powell, one of his first major films was a film called The Edge of the World, and it was all about the depopulation of the outer Scottish islands, the Shetlands in fact. Somehow Lullaby for Lucy reminds me of that desolation in Michael Powell's film, the sadness of the population decrease on the Scottish islands and the loss of a way of life. And Lullaby for Lucy is a sort of conjuring up of life again, I find. So let's hear it.
Oh.
Well, that was Lullaby for Lucy, but we're going to end our Scottish sojourn with Maxwell Davies's Orkney Wedding with Sunrise, which was written in the mid-1980s. It was played at the Last Night of the Proms, 1992, as I remember. It's a spectacular piece. It's an evocation of a whiskey-fueled wedding party. The sun rises majestically over the ocean and the cliffs, and the people come out to greet the rising sun. The great thing about the Orkney Wedding with Sunrise is that the great solo part in this piece is for a bagpiper. So there's a magnificent ending with the whole orchestra and this glistening sunshine on the ocean, and the bagpiper comes out to greet the dawn. It's a marvellous way to end
our journey to Scotland, our tour of the Western Isles, and a bit more than that. Okay?
And a bit more than that. Yes. And I very much hope that all true Scots and everybody who loves Scotland will enjoy this music.
Well, from Footnotes, myself, Richard Dove, and Stuart Milson will leave you with Sir Peter Maxwell Davies.